All right, so my name is Tiffany Gerber, and I'm here interviewing Barbara Black Deer McKenzie in the Wage Center at the University of Wisconsin Eau Claire on March 4th, 2009 at 11:20 a.m. All right, so we will begin our interview. First off, these are kind of going to be background information we'll start with. So our first question, date and place of your birth, which you already discussed as La Crosse, Wisconsin, and birth date 8/16/1967. And what would you describe as your race?
Well, I'm both of white ancestry and Native American race. Oftentimes when I'm in the mainstream community, I get qualified as Native American. When I'm in the Native American community, they recognize me as more white.
Sure. So. Which Native American community do you?
Ho-Chunk.
Ho-Chunk Nation, okay. And what is your ancestry or ethnicity then?
I'm half Norwegian and half Ho-Chunk.
Okay. And on your mother's side or father's side for the Ho-Chunk?
Father's
side. How many male and or female siblings do you have?
I have no direct siblings, but I do have, there's eight of them.
Wow.
That are half siblings.
Okay.
And maybe nine. No, eight. Well, we'll go through the list. My mother, in her prior marriage, had Gail, Rick, Robert, Harlan, Dave, and Deb. And then for my father's side, he had Patty and Caroline. Patricia Ennislow and Caroline Black Deer. So, and they were both by different mothers.
Okay. We'll skip over. What is your birth order in the family then?
I'm youngest.
Youngest. Yay, me too. What is the name and occupation of your partner or spouse, if you do have one?
He's a systems administrator for the Ho-Chunk Nation.
And would you say the name as well?
Oh, Andrew Douglas McKenzie.
You.
He goes by Drew.
Drew, okay. And how many children do you have, if any?
Two.
Two? Boys or girls?
I have one boy, one girl.
And what are their ages?
My daughter, Jo, is 13, and my son, William, is 11.
Okay. So I'm going to assume no grandchildren?
Not yet.
All
right. Ho-Chunk, we have got thousands of them, but...
Sure, not any personal descendant. Okay. Where did you attend school, and what degrees have you earned?
Well, I attended Holman High School. And then got the general high school diploma there. Then I went to Winona State University and got my Bachelor of Arts in Communication Studies and in History. Then I got my MEPD here at UW-Eau Claire, and I'm working on my EDS currently through Winona State with the possibility of transferring that into an EDD or PhD.
Okay, what is EDS exactly?
An education specialist.
Okay.
It allows me to get my principal and superintendent licensure, but it also doubles as more of an administrative degree component that, say, if I were working in a higher ed institution, it qualifies me more for being like a department chair or program director or something of that nature.
Okay. Is there anything else about your general background that you think is important for us to know?
No, the questions are pretty thorough. So.
Okay. We'll move on to stories from childhood and adolescence. So the first question would be to describe your relationship with your parents and siblings when you were growing up.
Let's see. My siblings were out of the house by the time I was five. So, we had the typical, they were my babysitter kind of things. But as far as my parents were concerned, you know, from that point forward, it was more like I was kind of an only child. But, you know, obviously still had a lot of family coming home for holidays and that kind of thing. My mother was, you know, just a pure fountain of love. I don't know how she did that. I mean, she just seemed to be able to keep her temper always in check, and she was just somebody that had that radiating from her all the time. She's a, let's see, how would my husband put it? She was a friend to children and small animals. So,
yeah.
That's the kind of person she was. My dad was very traditionally steeped within Ho-Chunk ways. He was socialized that way. But he also made some choices along with his relatives, his brothers and sisters, where they had kind of talked amongst themselves, where all of us kids of our generation never learned to speak Ho-Chunk. And the primary reason was because they felt that we needed to fill our heads with information that would allow us to survive or be successful. So in that realm, I wasn't that steeped within Ho-Chunk ways, except for the fact that he exuded them all the time.
Sure.
So in that sense, when I went to work for the tribe, it was quite a different experience. But at the same time, there's still a lot of familiarity. But there's always that should factor, where people felt that, you know, my education, my cultural socialization should have been more thorough.
Sure.
This is the best way to put it.
Okay. At this point in time, then, do you speak the language?
I'm learning.
Learning.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about the community and neighborhood where you grew up?
I lived out in the country, so, the neighborhood was, you know, our closest neighbor was a quarter mile away, which, you know, in the scheme of things really isn't that far, but, you know, my backyard was the Mississippi and Black Rivers and Lake Onalaska, and, you know, across the street from us was a giant cornfield, so, you know, that's kind of the way it was. My dad was instrumental in our area to get 911 as well as a first responder system in place because we just had so many incidents, I guess, on the lake with people that just weren't careful enough on the water,
mm-hmm.
although, you know, there are times when there's nothing you can do, but for those people that were maybe not as careful as they could have been, it would have been nice to have more response.
Sure.
So he was very instrumental in that, as well as conservation programs for that kind of an environment. I don't know if you want to. It seems kind of odd, you know, we think about prairies and lovely prairie grasses when we think about environmental conservation, but this was more of a swamp. but Lake Onalaska was a man-made lake.
Okay.
Which a lot of people don't recognize, but it was done during the public works projects during the Roosevelt years. And because of that, that area prior to that time was more boggy, swampy kind of place. And you know, people still live there, but that was definitely the river rat era.
Sure. Okay, that's kind of cool. And it sounds like a lot of places for children to run around and
get some
trouble.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my best friends were, you know, woolly bear caterpillars and frogs. And, you know, we could see wildlife of all kinds, you know. And we had this one time when we were sitting out shucking corn, because it was August, of course. But there, we had this muskrat come across, and she had her two little babies. And then there was a skunk that wandered by with her two little babies. And we had a turtle come by with that scat of babies, and we're like, wow, this is pretty cool. So we get goofy things like that. Definitely, you know, we do the bald eagle watching in the spring, mm-hmm. and there did get to a point where, I don't know if the water got low enough, that must have been how it was, but there were deer on the islands that were out in the Mississippi, and we're like, how did that happen? We didn't know they could really swim.
Yeah,
so
sure.
They got out there somehow.
All right. The next question, then, is who had power and privilege in your community, and how did that affect you and your family?
Power and privilege in my community. Well, my mother was socialized in the era where, you know, she took care of the home and he did the, you know, bring home the bacon kind of routine. So that's how it was in the household. But as far as, like, the community aspects, when we were involved in, say, like, general mainstream politics, which my parents were very faithful, full-time Democrats forever, they would do fundraising and different things, and my dad had built a house expressly for the purpose of entertaining. He made himself a childhood promise that he was going to have the largest house on Bryce's Prairie, and he did. And that basement was more like a dance hall than anything, and we had jukeboxes and a bar and different things down there, and truly a dance floor. So, you know, people would come over and we would do political fundraising and different things. So in that paradigm, they were pretty powerful locally in being able to energize the local supporters for Democrats and that kind of thing. I would say that it was more county power, although it did extend regionally. As for Ho-Chunk Ways, my dad, it tended to run along who was oldest, and then birth order and that kind of thing, but primarily on the male side, more patriarchal. He eventually got to the point where he was in his late 50s, and he was kind of the elder of the clan. Most of the practice that took place that he would involve himself in was in the Black River area, which is where I now live. And with that, he never became a member of the Medicine Lodge, but he and his mother had been. But he was definitely able to maneuver within the lodge in the sense of, you know, he practiced faithfully and traditionally, and he would still pray in Ho-Chunk, and it would be on his own. I mean, there were no really community folks that would come around and do that kind of thing, although that happened too very occasionally. And our charge was kind of, as a family, to take care of a cemetery that was out by us. So I did learn some Ho-Chunk ways, although they were in English, of doing things. And that's where I was talking about the should thing.
Yeah.
At that point in time, because I'd done the prayers in English, there were people that didn't really honor that, because they said, oh, well, you know, if you're going to speak to the Creator, you need to do that in Ho-Chunk. Well, yes and no, but I never learned that.
Sure.
Yet, I still have that spirituality or that faith about me. Mm-hmm. So, that's kind of how that goes.
Okay.
So, his influence, I guess, was pretty strong, but he was still of a generation where there were a lot of people that fluently spoke Ho-Chunk, like he did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm told he didn't speak very much. I don't know if that was just he certainly spoke English a lot. So it's kind of odd to hear that fact about him. But
okay.
That's just, I guess, who he was.
Sure.
And I still continue to learn about him now. And it's been, he passed away in 1988, so.
I'm sorry.
Long time. It was a long time ago.
Sure. Still within that question, as far as power and privilege in your community coming from two separate communities, you know, and kind of getting back to the should idea, did you have any issues, you know, growing up and living within probably more of a white community with having your Ho-Chunk roots, or vice versa when you would be within the Ho-Chunk community, as far as power and privilege would be within that realm?
I guess so, but you know, it's not something that you necessarily recognize about yourself at the time.
Sure.
I had some different experiences as an adult that reflected back to that time and made me realize that, yeah, maybe that was a factor, but really it wasn't actively a part of my consciousness at the time.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we had, we would do a lot of programming at local schools, and I would be pulled out of school to do those kinds of events, and my mother was the MC, as it were, and my dad would be the singer and the performer, and I would be the dancer and that kind of thing, and then my mother would go through the artifacts that we held as a family, you know, just to teach kids a little bit about, well, at that time it was Winnebago culture, but now Ho-Chunk culture.
Okay, sure.
So, you know, that was one experience, and it was supposed to, you know, my parents always set it up as a source of pride. But, you know, they also weren't around, and I guess it didn't bother me as much because I was very strong in that sense of pride, to be proud of my heritage, where if kids were teasing me about it, then, you know, it just kind of slid off my back. But the teasing did happen, and it's still teasing that goes on today, not for me personally, but a lot of kids in school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stuff like the questions about, do you live in a teepee, and if you're a real Indian, why aren't you wearing feathers, and that kind of thing.
Sure. It's unfortunate. Moving on from that question, and kind of maybe following up on it, is what values did you learn from your family and other people and institutions within your community?
Well, a lot of that was adult learning, like I said, and kind of getting steeped into tribal ways. And the more I learned, the less I knew, of course. I think that's, you get to be kind of that way through age.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree.
But values, I mean, there was nothing really specifically out there that were statements, per se. But you had to realize that family is extremely important, above all else, that we would be together, and that we're there for each other through thick and thin and good and bad. And you know, just as much as you put out there in great things that you want people to know about you, mm-hmm. the awful things are there too, you know. So it's like that whole idea of they see warts and all, and they take you as a whole package, mm-hmm. which in its own way is embarrassing in some ways, but it's also extremely supportive. So that's a major value. Another one that's kind of unwritten is that we always love to eat. I think that's in all cultures, but Ho-Chunks sure like to eat. So, yeah, we have fun with that. There are other pieces, too, that recently, as we've been trying to construct some ideas for a school, we've been going through different value statements and trying to figure out what it is that we want to emphasize with students as the long-term messages we want them to leave with. And one of them is family. Another one is an appreciation for themselves, you know, as their own body that they need to take care of and that kind of thing. Others and having that interpersonal respect for one another. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the environment that they're in, whether it's a classroom in a very, you know, squarish building or, you know, out in nature doing conservation efforts. Okay. So that's another big one.
What occupations did your parents pursue?
My dad was an engineer on the Burlington Northern Railroad, and he did that for 32 years, and he graduated with a perfect safety record, which is extremely rare.
Yeah.
Because a lot of it is luck. You know, it takes a quarter of a mile to stop even a 30-car train. And back in those days, they were like, you know, 100, 120 cars. So that was pretty significant. And my mother was kind of on again, off again. She liked to work part-time just to get out of the house and to help supplement the family income. But she was an excellent secretary at all levels, you know. And if you think about the old manual typewriters, and she was one of the fastest and most perfect typists that I've ever seen. And she taught me a lot of different office skills, which I still employ today. I see different people who are, you know, more of the executive class like I am in now for different work, and I see that they don't really know how to efficiently stamp a whole bunch of letters or to stuff different envelopes and different things. And those were all things that I learned through her and her skills, which she applied in her position with Al Baldus, who was a 3rd District Congressman. And she was one of his caseworkers for the La Crosse office. So she worked closely with D.C. and up here in Eau Claire.
Okay. So they were really involved with the Democratic.
Oh, yeah. And then she would be asked to head up the different campaign offices as office manager and that kind of thing, too.
So kind of going backing up with different values and things, did you find politics to be any kind of a value or something that they handed down to you as something that it,
yeah.
you know, is very important?
And my dad was pretty forthright in saying, look, you know, it's your responsibility to vote. You know, it wasn't but 3 years, or not even that, 1 year before he was born, that Native Americans were recognized as U.S. citizens. So in that sense, when he was eligible to vote, you know, he started that pattern, and he started to recognize the ways of things, and said, well, you know, if we can influence this politician or if we can do, you know, that kind of a program, then, you know, somehow we'll be able to navigate into a better position where we can help our people. And that's something that he practiced his entire life. And definitely made an impression on me, because I ended up following through with public relations on a much larger scale.
Great. what role did education play in your life?
My life? Oh, it was huge. You know, there was, one, it was automatic. My parents were, you're going to college, there's no two ifs, ands, or buts about it. You're going, and that's it. It was an expectation, you know, so I remember sitting freshman year in the dorm at Winona State University saying, I'm here, now what? And it was really a now what kind of a moment, in the sense that I'm like, okay, I made it to college, now what the heck am I supposed to do here?
Yeah.
So, you know, in that K-12 setting, it's really very structured for you. So, you know that you're going for the general requirements, and, you know, and people put me on the college track, and I was aware of that kind of thing. But to sit there in the dorm room and to figure that out, you know, I was definitely one of those people that did not have a declared major, or if I did, it was like a marquee on the door. It changed every minute.
Mm-hmm.
So I just didn't know. By the time I had to proclaim a major in my junior year, I still was unsure. So I did end up graduating in two different programs.
With the communications and what was the other?
History.
History, that's right. That's what I have as an undergrad, too, here. can you give an example of how gender, race, ethnicity, and social class were important in building your understanding of yourself and society and as a whole?
That's a huge,
loaded question.
It really is. Gender. I recognized, and it struck me for a long time that somehow I was not as powerful as a woman in this patriarchal realm of being Ho-Chunk. But I have definitely learned through time that it's not a matter of being patriarchal, it's just the ways that I saw power being exercised.
Sure.
In the sense that, you know, my dad was participating. Well, my mom was Norwegian, so she wasn't participating. You know, on that side of things in my household was, you know, I had been given my Indian name when I was a baby, you know, so that protected my spirit through that belief system.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was also baptized and confirmed Lutheran. So, you know, I was also protected in that faith system. But as far as figuring out what sacraments I was going to end up following, that was a totally different thing. And I have my own spirituality, so I mean, I'm not participating in what my husband would call any dogma. Any particular dogma.
Okay.
But I also have learned that with Ho-Chunk, it's not just this patriarchal power path. It's just what I saw. There's definitely a female path, and it's different. It is different and identifiable. It's just that I've never, I can't say never, but rarely been exposed to it. So I don't really know those ways. Oftentimes I've been quote-unquote put back in my place for pursuing different things that I saw my dad do, but overall it's only been to help, and I think people understand that, so they've never been too critical of me in that realm.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, that one's a bad question.
Well, I mean, and two, you know, to follow up on that last comment, I've noticed that that's where I've become a leader unto myself, because it's really given me a platform for, one, women to step up within the tribe, and then two, to kind of hold the guys accountable and say, look, you know, if you're not going to be a father in the household, or if you're not going to be someone that fulfills this ritual or this ceremony, then somebody has to do it. It's part of who we are, and it's not just the ritual. There's something behind the ritual here that has to be done. And if you're not going to step up and do it, then the women will.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, you know, like I said, I've gotten criticism for it, but it's something that needed to be done.
Sure.
And we just fill in those gaps.
Yeah. So as far as growing up between, you know, I'm looking at dual communities almost, in a sense, when did you find that self-empowerment with having a struggle between, you know, being a female, but yet growing up in a time when the females' roles changing?
My dad was fiercely independent on that point. He had seen my sister Caroline go through a really nasty marriage with, you know, a ho-chunk man that he theoretically never approved of, and he was dead set on making sure that, you know, I was the college-bound one and that I wasn't going to follow in her footsteps, and he would use her pretty explicitly as an example on what he did and didn't like about her relationships and different things like that. So in that sense, he empowered me to do a lot of things that normally wouldn't have been given to women to do, like different prayers and things like that.
Okay.
But he was also one to make sure that, let's see, how did he used to put it? He would say, you have to be able to succeed on your own, like if you have kids or anything, and don't rely on the man at all. So, you know, be prepared for everything that you're going to do, and that I needed to be able to handle those responsibilities. So, you know, when the time came, he passed away while I was in college, and I was 20 years old, probably the start, or just the end of my sophomore year. And with that in mind, you know, one of the things was birth control. I didn't know the tribal position on it. I still don't know if there is one or not. So, you know, that was an issue. Abortion became a question in my mind at one point, but I ended up miscarrying. Those were all different things that impacted where I wondered what the position was, but I really had no one to ask. So I had to make my own decisions for myself.
Why didn't you feel like you could ask your parents that?
My mother didn't know, and by then my father had passed.
Okay. Yeah,
okay. So, and, you know, theoretically, you know, aunts and people like that are supposed to fulfill those roles, but I really didn't have anybody that I knew well enough within the tribe to do something like that. I think that's part of why my family chose, you know, like two generations back, to live in the areas that we did, so that there was more autonomy for them to live their lives the way that they wanted to. And because of that, you know, you separate off from that main hub of support and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you discover who you are a lot
faster.
Yeah,
you're building inner strength.
Yeah.
Within your own family, sure, immediate family. Okay. what memories do you have, if any at all, of being discriminated against or seeing others who are victims of discrimination?
I think, well, my skin color is such that it's pretty mainstream. People say that I can pass as a Southern European, like Italian or Spanish or something like that. And that's very true. So the type of discrimination that I experienced was more based on my name. And then as I grew, you know, where I kept thinking of these things as negatives in my life, mm-hmm. I started to turn them into my strengths. So by the time that I got married, I made the active choice to keep my maiden name attached to my new surname.
Sure.
So I guess that's kind of where that goes. The childhood experiences, like I mentioned before, were based more on, you know, do you live in a teepee and that kind of thing, and the war whoops on the playground and things like that. And I'd kind of gone through a period, even in, I'm confusing everything here. Trying to go chronologically here. So we had the playground incidents. By the time I reached middle school, hey, all kids are evil to each other, so I can't really count that. By the time I reached high school, you know, and you're thinking about dating and things like that, that never really happened for me. And I think it's because I was primarily in a very homogenous setting. I was one of two Native Americans, one half Vietnamese person, and one Mexican American out of, you know, a district of thousands of kids.
Wow.
So, I mean, we're talking homogeny as far as white race. You know, the ethnicity, on the other hand, was more, you know, German and Swiss and definitely Norwegian, heavy Norwegian influence. So I was definitely seen as the other, different. Then when I reached college, it was more of a free-form setting where I could discover different things about multiculturalism and pieces like that. I was just telling my daughter this the other week, where when I first went to Winona State and they had this minority scholarship to help offset expenses and stuff, and it was $500, you know, not huge in the scheme of things, but it certainly helped.
Mm-hmm.
And the first few semesters that I'd gone through it, the diversity vice president had just basically handed me the check. And he was a white guy and, you know, middle-aged, typical, you know, typical for that era, definitely. That was more, you know, middle-aged male administrator, white administrator. And then we had a new vice president of diversity come in. And he was this gorgeous purple-black man. You know, just that skin color, I can just think of it and just say, wow. And he turned everything on its ear. All of a sudden, you know, yeah, he still gave us the checks and things at first because that's what we were accustomed to. But then he would have these little side projects that he would expect us to assist him with, whether it was peer tutoring or like freshman orientation with other students of color. Eventually we got to a Global Awareness Day, which I see is still in place. They just ran another one very recently at the schools in that area. And, you know, that was all stuff that I was involved at the foundation of, because there was somebody who knew what it would take to make us as students of color feel empowered. So that exploration time was very interesting, because I, like many people, went into a realm of hypersensitivity. You know, and that was, you know, my activist era and that kind of thing. And I kind of slowly brought the gauge back to what I would consider a better, more realistic balance in my perceptions about, you know, when people use specific language. You know, like the phrase, hey, that's calling a spade, or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or red tape. Those types of language usage, I'll take the person aside and I'll correct them now, but that was definitely an era where I'd be right there in their faces and saying, do you realize how, you know, inappropriate that language is, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's where I started to turn my minority status into a strength for myself. Because of that, I don't think a lot of Native Americans get to go through that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're still grossly underrepresented at the college level across the United States. So while the statistics are improving, I know that a lot of people haven't gone through that mind-opening self-exploration realm. They're very much steeped within this protective, supportive culture.
Mm-hmm.
For better and for worse. So there's kind of that draw that's an entrapment, you know, and for some people that causes, you know, AODA type issues, generational depression, even some historic trauma response. But it's something that they're making an active choice on just as much as anybody else. They could choose to go out and come back, and that is pretty well supported among people. It's just that a lot of people don't take advantage of it. So what we would consider as a traditional age college student within the tribe is more like 28, 29 years old. It's not right out of high school. And it's because that they've made an active choice to pursue something that would help them and their families earn more money in general. So they really use that idea of schooling as a way to improve your economic status, as opposed to schooling for education's sake or broadening your horizons.
Okay. What have you learned from experiencing or witnessing acts of discrimination or things similar to?
I really want to say that, and it's because I believe that people are well-intended, but when they do something that's ignorant or arrogant, that's something I still have to engage as a point of education, particularly if they hold any status or power in a given institution. And since I've chosen education as my realm, then that's kind of where it ends up manifesting itself. I was shocked this past year when I headed up a task force on Native American truancy and absenteeism for a local school district. And we've got some of the best educated people in our community in those positions. You know, they're bachelor's minimum, if not master's or PhD. And the statements that would come from them were so ignorant that it was frustrating. You know, people using the we, you know, our school district has done this and that and the other thing, and when is the tribe going to step up? And, you know, the we, they mentality instead of seeing it as a joint process. And that was extremely frustrating. Because, well, it's just frustrating for any number of reasons, but in particular because I guess I would expect more of a person who's been schooled so much.
Sure. So you've kind of taken education as your shield and sword almost to fight through.
When I first was working with UW-Eau Claire, I was still in the mode of, I just been on a stint as PR officer for our Office of the President, so I was definitely a practicing journalist, PR person. And in that experience, I had spent so much time with reporters on the phone where I was giving them an hour of background before I would make a statement that they could use as a sound clip or a sound bite or whatever. And it was just as frustrating for me as it was for them to want to, you know, get in, get out, and do the quick fix in journalism. You know, and they have their deadlines and they have their time frames and expectations as well. It's like, well, I want to make sure, though, that the story is coming out right. And that put me on a path of, I want to get into higher education and touch these journalists before they get out and start the reporting. And so I applied for the position here at UW-Eau Claire under Dave Gordon as the night journalist in residence. And we had an extraordinary pool for that. And Lynette Nyman and myself were the two people that were chosen, even though the grant would only support one person. So Dave really went through the ranks here and, you know, talked to Larry Martin, who was the head of AIS, to see if they could have me cross-teach, and then also went through Steve Talent's office and Ron Satz, and I think even through Don Mash at one point, because we ended up going to the foundation for soft money, and Dave was the one that did all of that. And he came back and he said, you know, glad to say this, we're going to list you as an instructor, and we're going to have Lynette as the journalist in residence, and she's going to be working primarily on the Hmong community, and you're going to work on American Indians in the media. And so with that, we were able to work in tandem, which really pulled the First Nations New Nations program together very quickly in that first year. And it was just amazing to be able to experience the different pieces that Lynette brought to the table, and that and I was showing her, and we just bounced off each other really well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really cool. And then Dave was fantastic, and I think I'd have to credit his own diverse background. He happens to be Jewish, and it, I think, helped to open up doors that probably wouldn't have been open otherwise.
Sure.
And then Ron Satz, being, American Indian Studies guru that he was,
mm-hmm.
That was huge. And Steve being, the open guy that he is, was definitely part of that whole schema.
Great. A few more questions with this area.
Oh, but then I didn't finish that one.
Oh.
Okay, so we did the whole reporters. That's what drew me here. And then I found out that it wasn't just reporters. I was seeing this in like the CJ 105 class, where I recognized the diversity aspects were issues across the board. And that's when I started working pretty heavily with the PR class, and then teaching them how to work with different constituent groups. And I went through Ron Satz's office and said, well, we're going to invite the local politicians and that kind of thing to campus so that they can see how white students and how students of color are getting along. But specifically, I had pretty well trained my PR people that said, whatever it takes within yourself, you have to figure out what diversity on campus means to you. And some of the things were just amazing, where they would come out with what eventually became what I would consider a standard multicultural protocol, something that we within multicultural education expect to see.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a wonderful international student from South America, and she'd come up to me and she's like, who are these people? And why do they want me to sign this petition that I support diversity? I said, go talk to them for a while. She's like, but they're white students. And I said, well, go talk to them, test them out. So Alejandra went up there, and she grilled them, and eventually signed the diversity petition and came back. She's, they're okay. And it took a semester, to
sure.
work through that process. But I recognized then that it was an issue for the entire student body, which then subsequently made me recognize, okay, this isn't just at UW-Eau Claire, it's everywhere. So that really focused me into the realm of education.
That's
what I was going to say.
Kind of going to skip over a few of these questions here. Maybe can you think of a memory of your childhood that continues to make a difference in your life? A specific memory?
I'm trying to think of one. I mean, there's so much from my childhood. I had a very happy childhood. And like I said at the beginning, it wasn't really that I noticed a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this within different social groups, whether it's socioeconomic poor or whatever. They don't recognize that they're poor when they're there. Well, I didn't recognize I was a different race while I was in it. So to say, to pull out one memory that's based on race, I can't really say that there was.
Okay. Maybe what significant historical events do you recall most clearly from your childhood, and how have they affected you through your lifetime?
Okay, Watergate was my era. And the reason it affected me so much, seeing all these different guys on television, well, first, we didn't have cable. That was huge. We only had the broadcast station, so there was, your CBS, ABC, NBC, and your public television. And that was it. And I would come home from school as this little kindergartner, and I'm like, where's Gomer Pyle reruns, and there was nothing on except these hearings, and eventually it got to the point where I started to pay attention to what was going on. And it wasn't a deep attention span to it, obviously. I'm a six-year-old kid. But it made me see that a series of events was going on and falling into place. And we successively went into the Ford era and then eventually Carter. And my mother was so involved with the Carter campaign that eventually she ended up receiving an inaugural ball invitation for his inauguration, which was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also the bicentennial year, 1976. So there was a lot of attention on that as well. So patriotism was a big message. To move from there, the other life-changing events, I mean, we just had such a successive growth within that period. And we had everything from, the personal computers coming out in 82, but I didn't touch one until I went to college in 86. I'd learned about computers in fourth grade, but that was with vacuum tubes. Nor NAND circuits and those types of things, which is completely unheard of now. Kids would be like, what? They've never heard of a byte. They only heard of gigs and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought those things were amazing, and that's where my husband is absolutely just interesting me, because he always grew up with computers in his household. And his dad actually helped to write the C language and the COBOL language. So he was part of those projects in the 40s and 50s and 60s and into the 70s and 80s. He was more into the mainframe type computers and things like that.
We're going to stop for one moment. Okay.
if I were going to say that there was specific affecting events, I didn't really necessarily recognize them in and of themselves for what they were, but certainly it was around me. In that same era, with Watergate and things like that, AIM was very active.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no clue what that was. But Russell Means had come to our house and talked to my dad. And people would just, they would drive up and he'd say, well, who's that? Oh, I don't know. And he'd go out in the yard and he'd go talk to them and he'd find out who they are and what they wanted. And, sometimes it was as minimal as, I grew up here to people like Russell Means. And he would have these conversations with them. And it was just amazing. I'm like, well, why are, it made me question 20 years later, why are they talking to you, Dad? And it turned out because he was very influential also in the tribal council. He had been involved with our constitutional government when it was finally approved by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in 1966. He was one of the first full BC, WWBC legislators, Wisconsin Winnebago Business Committee. So in that scheme of things, he was very familiar with our constitution. He was familiar with the kinds of dynamics it took to get things done within the mainstream political realm, and to make sure that the people eventually would have greater access to jobs and housing and different things that the people really needed. And I think that that's something that's still really grossly misunderstood about Native America. People don't realize that for so long, essentially since the resettlements in the 1800s, people on reservations have been living in third world conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And, when you put it that way and you say, well, do you remember those commercials that you would see for, helping the starving children in Africa? Well, we've got that same thing within the United States, and people just have their blinders on and don't want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly existed then. I think that things have improved where, with some versions of equity, taking place, like the casinos and different things, tribes have been able to make great advances in terms of helping their people. But people also have to recognize that, you know, the casinos are a facade. You know, not all of us live like, you know, Donald Trump and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We're still using that money to help with basic infrastructure for safe water and, you know, decent housing and things for people. So it's still something that goes on now. You know, but the power holders back in the day, you know, in my father's era, was something that, you know, he encouraged me to do as well. He would introduce me to everyone. And I remember one case in particular where one of our relatives came to the house. His name's Billy O'Brien, and he was an actor in Hollywood, and he had been cast in the role of Injun Joe for Tom Sawyer. And Injun Joe is this very scary character. So, of course, you know, I'd seen the Disney version, and I was just really afraid of him. He's such a teddy bear. Billy is a great man. He was just really awesome. You know, and I miss him. So, you know, but all of these elders have walked on now. And so it's kind of left up to my generation now to pick up what pieces we can and continue to try and put the people back together. And I think that it's an exhausting job because you just have these remnants left. You know, if you think about, you know, a vase that's just shattered, you know, you could find a few big pieces here and there, but it's those little pieces where you know that there's a crack and then there's a piece missing that you haven't found yet or may never find. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what's happened with that cultural decimation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to skip over the last questions about childhood and move into feminist identities. Can you describe your occupational path after college?
Oh, I jumped right into grad school. That was a mistake. Because I wasn't focused enough to know exactly what I wanted. So I jumped back into retail. It was a very safe haven for me. Service industry, people, customer service, cash registers, Christmas rush, all that kind of stuff. So that's what I did. I ended up working at Mall of America when that had just opened. And it was interesting. I ended up working for the Nature Company. I love that place. I wish it still existed, but it was taken over by the Discovery Channel store. Mm-hmm. And they were in the process of consolidating the Scientific Revolution, which was a whole bunch of toys and things and based in science, into this nature realm, which we covered because, you know, we sold telescopes and binoculars and astronomy and different educational toys there as well. Well, I had no idea that my assistance in that project would end up being a determining factor for me to eventually come back and get a job with the tribe. I was thinking, you know, whatever. But it was soon after that my husband and I met, you know, and we weren't yet married and that kind of thing. But we met in the Twin Cities, and eventually we married in August of 94. We started a family right away, and I got this nesting instinct where I said, I have to go home. I can't have my baby, you know, here in the cities. I have to go to a rural area or something akin to that. So we ended up coming back to La Crosse. I ended up coming back. He was nowhere near from here. And doing a series of odd jobs because we, you know, we had no connections anymore, no realm of possibility into anything but temporary positions for a few months and, you know, trying to basically restart our lives. So we kind of made this promise to each other, whomever got the better job first would be the one to be, you know, the one to take home the bacon and that kind of stuff, and the other would take care of the baby. Well, I was the one that ended up finding the position first, and it was with the tribe. It turned out that there was a huge demand for the kind of knowledge that I had. And that was not only in retail, but then also in corporate understanding, and economic development and acquisitions. And so, you know, I started off at like a $14 an hour job, which was pretty good at that time. Well, still kind of is. And as a training officer. And then my supervisor decided to pursue other things, and he promoted me into his position. So I became the chief administrative officer. And that was the last time that I saw a permanent type of job in a regular setting. After that, I was exposed for 90 days, and unbeknownst to me, there were people within the tribe that were fast-tracking me to get me exposed to a number of different areas as quickly as possible and to encourage me to keep moving on. And of course, the big dangling carrot at that point was money. And you could do no wrong with the casino. It's really hard to not make money with the casino. So they just kept dropping these different things in my lap and saying, okay, now you're the CAO, so you're responsible for grievances for 2,000 people. Okay. Training officer, I had, you know, 20 people and a budget of $100,000 to work with. Mm-hmm. Now all of a sudden it was, you know, these grievances for everybody, and I'm trying to cost cut from, you know, $250,000 of employee issues and trying to navigate those waters. Well, it wasn't but, you know, the 90-day probationary period after that, that they then offered me the executive director of business. And then, in doing so, they said, well, now you're responsible for basically generating all the money that the tribe gets, aside from grants, and that's only $20 million. Well, when they're saying only $20 million, you're kind of going, huh. You know, at the time, I don't think I could even fill out an Excel spreadsheet properly. You know, so I was getting a little panicky, and they said, oh, you'll have help, and you'll have staff, and you'll be able to do this and that. So, you know, there I went into this position of the executive director of business and ended up being responsible and taking on that responsibility of generating, you know, basically $250 million a year. And then immediately after that, I was offered the position in the office of the president as the PR officer. Then all of a sudden, it wasn't just the 2,500 or 3,000 employees that I was responsible for. Now it was the 6,600 people plus the 2,000 employees that I was responding on behalf of. It takes time to meet that educational curve and to accept those kinds of things, and it was definitely a unique experience, but I can definitely say that it did happen, and I would never want anybody else to have to go through what I did without any warning. So when I started teaching the PR classes here, that was something I told them. It was a story I related to them and said, you may not find yourself in that position, the majority of you won't, but for the one of you who might, be aware that it can happen. And if it happens to you, these are some of the things I learned.
Sure.
So it brought very practical experience into the classroom.
And then that was your last experience before coming to teaching at the university? Okay.
I'd gone through several positions, but throughout the tumultuous era of our new constitutional government that was put in place in 94, the thing that I think strikes me most is that in that period we went through six different presidents. And every single one of them was my supervisor. And every single one of them, even through the transitions and through all of the office cleaning and different things that happened and sweeping you know, gross amounts of intellectual capital out of those offices, they kept me on. So there's a staying power, a fortitude that I must somehow express. That's just a part of who I am.
Sure.
It's crazy. It was absolutely crazy making. My husband would be like, every time you get a new job, you cry for 6 weeks. This I know about you.
So this whole section of questions is going along the lines of crafting feminist identities. So my next question would be along the lines of, when and how were you awakened to social inequalities based on gender, race, social class, sexual orientation, and other various layers of identity? Would that be kind of like when you were in high school and you were talking, that was kind of your more
well, that was the dating
activism
era. But I would say that it was even before that with my own parents. There were times when I would question why my mom chose to only work part-time when she seemed to be the better skilled. I mean, my dad earned a lot of money for what he did. It's just that it would seem that with the skills that my mom had, that she would have been higher up on the ladder. And people did ask her to, you know, run for legislative positions and different things. She would always shy away from it. You know, she'd never step into those types of roles. She didn't feel that was a place for her. And so, you know, I had that recognition immediately in my life. And then it got stronger as my different school experiences, even in K through 12, where people would put me in these different situations to either single me out or put me forward or promote me or whatever the case might be.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you know, I'm not only representing myself, I'm representing my race, my class, my gender.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be kind of tough,
yeah.
You know, in trying to forge that type of identity. And for a while I denied it, you know, and actively tried to step away from leadership roles. And I was dissatisfied with the outcomes just as much as everybody else was. You know, people would actually be angry with me because they knew that the potential was there. And they would, you know, do the same types of things they do to gifted kids that, you know, I was experiencing also at that time. It'd be like, you're not living up to your potential. You're not fulfilling your gifts, and you're not honoring them properly. And it's like, oh, who are you to say what I'm doing, you know? But, you know, you eventually take on that social message from your peers and colleagues and different people where, you know, they recommend you for something, and you kind of have to see that as the social honor it is. Even at the beginning here, when we started, you know, I asked you how I came to your attention,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that was part of the story, too. It's now just become a point of intrigue for me rather than something I sidestep.
Sure.
But gender-wise, yeah, between that and eventually working for the tribe starting in that 1996, that was a big lesson because they'd never had a female executive director of business. People weren't familiar with female bosses, especially within the tribe, let alone an educated female boss. And then going into the public relations officer position, you know, they're like, well, she's got the communication degree. You know, and then there'd be that traditional factor. They'd say, well, she's not part of the Buffalo Clan. She's not supposed to speak on behalf of the tribe. The Buffalo Clan is. If she's Deer Clan, she doesn't do that. And it's like, well, yeah, I do because I am in communications and that's what I do. I eventually came to realize that, you know, the culture's kind of like this huge onion. There's a core to it. And I saw that core was like the medicine lodge, the traditional government with the chief and the lower chiefs and things like that. And then you go out a couple of layers. You know, and you get a different level of what that interaction would be. You come out some more from those layers, and you end up with the constitutional government. I guess that's where I saw my place to be, because I was half Norwegian, just as much as anything. So I didn't feel like I would ever be part of that core, mm-hmm. that I could commit to that level of, well, having everybody in my business as much as getting that much support in the religion.
Sure.
So it's an interesting balance, but that's where I kind of choose to stay now. And I would say I'm still part of that onion, definitely. But I'm way in from, you know, the flaky edges, but I'm definitely not part of the core either.
Okay, sure. I just wanted to skip over some of these because they seem a little bit repetitive.
That's fine.
Could you describe the process you went through as you decided to identify yourself as a feminist?
We got into a conversation, and it was my Aunt Eunice, and my mom, and one of my sisters, and it was at my high school graduation. And somehow we got on the topic of birth control and abortion, which, you know, those were taboo points of conversation, especially within my family for some reason. And my mother ended up stating her position for the first time that I had ever heard of in my life. And here I am, you know, tender age of 17. And she's saying, well, yeah, I'm you know, pro-choice, and you know, I think that women should engage in birth control if that's their choice and that's what they want. And, you know, as a mom of 8 kids, you know, natural live births herself, I'm sure that had an impact. You know, and I'm sure that her career ideas were affected by that. Certainly going to school was. She never went to college. Both of my parents had a high school diploma. And that's as far as they ever went. So I was shocked. My mother's pro-choice, like I am? And so I had already developed my position from like sophomore health classes and stuff like that, and said, well, yeah, I think people need the choice. And it turned out, you know, that was my sophomore year in high school. My sophomore year in college, it got to be an even bigger deal as I was doing the study of language and different things. And I started really thinking about the word choice. You know, what does that mean? You know, what is a democracy? What is freedom? You know, so all of those political things started coming back just as much as anything else. But then to try and work out for myself what the ideas of choice meant. And I had a professor, Tennyson Williams at Winona State, who, after a keynote speech by Elie Wiesel, the Auschwitz survivor and founder of the International Humanitarian Foundation, Nobel Peace Prize winner, Tenney had a talk the next day after Elie Wiesel had spoken, and he said, think about the language aspects, the language of hate. You know, and that was Wiesel's big message, is that we have, if there's anything that we have to do, we have to eradicate hate. You know, and as we started talking about that in class, then Tenney brought up this idea of choice. What is it to choose? Do you choose to wear a seatbelt? Do you choose to wear a motorcycle helmet? Do you choose to lock your door at night? You know, and he brought it from everything in the mundane, you know, to do you choose a generic or a brand product in a grocery store for a can of pears, or, you know, what are you going to choose to do? Mm-hmm. And to this entire degree, to the point where he brought it to the more controversial. So it was fascinating to think through that finally and say, wow, I really am pro-choice. And I try to live by that value system, which, you know, a lot of ways it can be very dicey at times, especially being a parent. I want to say, you're going to do this and you're going to do it now and you're going to do it this way. You know, but I try as much as I can, you know, and I tried to introduce the concept of making good choices and exercising sound judgment and still applying creativity and those types of things to my kids, even as they were like 2 years old. So, you know, my daughter's got a really good head on her shoulders. I'm still a little bit concerned about my son, but, you know, my husband keeps saying, hey, it's just a boy thing. All right, it's a boy thing, but whatever. He's got to start showing me that he can do this, or I'm going to get really freaked out here pretty soon. So he's pretty funny that way.
Next question is a little bit bigger, too. Feminism has been described as a river with many tributaries. In other words, although feminists are united by some common beliefs, they understand and express those beliefs differently. How do you describe the tributary of feminism that best fits your beliefs?
Probably as liberal as you can get it. I want to live in a society where I am free to make the choices that I so choose. And I accept the consequences, where if my gut reaction might initially be to say no to something or to someone or to a group, I reconsider that very quickly. And, you know, that's come with time and a lot of effort, especially when it comes to things, you know, like we should have nuclear weaponry or things like that. That's still one that's really hard for me to choke down. You know, but when it comes to what I would consider more advertised or politicized types of issues, like civil marriage and civil union and those types of things, I'm all for it.
Sure.
And that's like an automatic for me. I know it's not an automatic for a lot of people, but it's just how I've already built my paradigm, my schema of things.
Sure. And how does the phrase "the personal is political" affect your feminist identity? Or what does that phrase hold for you?
It has to. It's all of it. I can safely say that as a Native American, just as much as I can a feminist, because I've seen the consequences when the civil rights are denied. And if we're going to, you know, put ourselves out there as land of the free and home of the brave and those types of patriotic ideals, then we have to be able to walk the walk just as much as we talk it.
Mm-hmm.
It's so personal for me, especially on the race levels. It doesn't affect me as much, I guess, with gender, although it sure did during Hillary's past run here. I know that the campus, generally speaking, you know, had a lot of students were just, you know, pro-Obama and different things. But when it came to pre-primary, I was like, okay, people are talking about his minority status. But we have a woman here who's exceptionally, even overqualified to be president. When is the next time we're going to see this?
Mm-hmm.
And it was very difficult for me to try to convince people that they should vote for Hillary, because they were so bent on saying, well, you know, if we're going to examine this, I said, well, look at it statistically. 52% of the world's population are female, and yet we've had an historical base, we have a candidate base that's still in the majority male,
mm-hmm.
Even representation in the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And until that gets to be 52%, I don't see that that there's a sense of equity, because the voice in our democracy is not whole. You know, and when you base that on a geographical region and people put in their preferences and different things, I think it's still extremely difficult for a woman to navigate politics. It certainly gotten a lot better through my lifetime, but it seems like women who will do political work, like my mom did for so long, are almost satisfied to stay out of the fire by exuding influence over the power holders, rather than being the policy decision makers themselves. I think that that's valid for a democracy, but I don't necessarily see that as being very healthy if we're going to define ourselves as a democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, we need to say that it is representative democracy and qualify it constantly with that term, or call it what it is, which is technically a republic.
Yeah.
Sure. That's a tough one.
We're
not there yet.
What what do you consider the greatest achievements of feminism over the past 25 years?
25 years. Bring me back to a year on that. What is that?
79.
Yeah, so it'll be 84, 85.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep,
85. So for the past 25 years.
1985.
Okay.
Technically.
Greatest advances. Birth control is still a huge one. And getting that knowledge out. You know, if we're going to keep a global awareness, I think that that's a huge piece of it. I continue to have my concerns over India and the population that's just so huge. We're hitting the billions now. And, you know, having been, and this is part of my identity too, been part of the class that was definitely imperialized. You know, I'm an historic beneficiary, as it were, of imperialism. People need a place to go. Where are they going to go? You know, we don't colonize anything anymore unless maybe Antarctica, but you're still removing penguins or whatever. You know, it's not native people necessarily, but penguins. What kind of respect do we have for that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And who wants to live in those conditions? And then there's going to be this huge social fight over the conditions that they do want to live in. You know, and then more advances theoretically into space. You know, are we going to destroy our universe or respect it? You know, and those are choices that people have to make. Greatest strides is in the past 25 years. Seen a lot more women in professional positions. Management. My sister, Gail, is definitely one of those people who seemed like she was forging that path. She worked her way up from an IRS auditor into, you know, the top echelons of the organization, where she was training the Treasury Department and Homeland Security and different things on terror software by the time she retired. But she was always one to wear a suit to work. You know, and it was always a skirt with, you know, a blazer of some type and then a tie of some sort, whether it was a bow or, you know, a male-looking tie or whatever the fashion was at the time. It still was very indicative of this patriarchal control of management.
Mm-hmm.
And she exuded that. In the more traditional professions, I think that we've seen a sense of equity too, you know, for more men being considered kindergarten teachers and trying to work on that stereotype of, you know, the kindergarten male kindergarten teacher is a pedophile or something like that. You know, it's just, it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
There are some men that are very gifted in working with little kids,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's poopy pampers or whatever. They're just good at it. My husband is one of them.
Yeah.
But he's a bigger bra-burning feminist than I am. Truly. You know, he's funny that way, but that's the way his mom raised him. And she was definitely part of that as well, to try and put that out there. She was definitely, let's see, that's third wave feminism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so she was a third wave feminist in the ERA type era.
Sure.
So I don't know where that puts me. I guess I'm at the tail end of the third wave, where, you know, all of our bras are burnt and we got underwires instead, but, you know, go figure.
See, birth control, women in professional positions.
Yeah, and then finally seeing Hillary run. That was just so huge.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me hope that at some point we will actually see it in our lifetime. my lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, and so many opportunities have gone by. You know, I would have considered very heavily in the past people like Jean Kirkpatrick or Barbara Jordan or, you know, Elizabeth Dole. And I was just so happy that Hillary actually made the decision to do it. And she did. She did a fine job of it. And I was just so disappointed in so many spectators for the types of crap that they put out there. You know, come iron my shirts and that kind of thing. There's no place for that anymore. Even as a joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, kind of picking up where you're leaving off there, what do you think the challenges are that feminism will have to overcome for the rest of the century?
Getting that female president. Continuing to get women in empowered positions. And it's not just the social dynamic necessarily, but the true power decision-making dynamic where they're the ones that are creating policy for the organization and they're the ones that are controlling it and managing it in the fashion that they see as best fit for the task at hand,
mm-hmm.
whatever their production or service might be. And something that I still see as a huge dynamic is that idea that women are empowered socially, but they won't necessarily be taken seriously for their initiative and ideas, and instead are relegated to this, well, you manage people, and you do a nice job of that. And it's like, oh, so patronizing.
Mm-hmm.
Truly. I mean, right into the language. It's patronizing.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Maybe switching gears from that, talking about your experience here on campus. Do you want to start with when you first got here as...
Well, I was wonderfully empowered through Dave Gordon. That was just amazing. And he was so supportive of different efforts, and he mentored me just as much as anything. And, you know, truly felt like a colleague. You know, and that's pretty special when you think, you know, I just came in here as an instructor, and I was teaching on campus with just a bachelor's. You know, and that was a very special status.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and obviously the rules got tighter the more I was on campus and things, and they said, oh, she's got to get her master's. Okay, well, fine, I did that. you know, but there were challenges in and of themselves just regarding getting the master's. I mean, it's so rare within a tribe. It's sickeningly rare.
Mm-hmm.
I can name 10 people that have their PhDs in my entire nation. That's it.
Wow.
Out of 6,600 people, 10. And as I pursue mine, I recognize the fact that I am a role model in that scheme of things. But the institution seems to feel like it's so easy to do, and it's not. It's definitely a point of recognition. You recognize that in your own master's program. You know, you hold yourself to high standards, and you fulfill the expectations that you think are going to be what people are expecting, your colleagues and professors and supervisors and so on, but it's not an easy path to navigate.
When you came on as a professor instructor, what year was that?
2003.
Okay. What is the first memory you have of instructing on campus or being here as far as connecting that with maybe feminism and diversity?
Well, I obviously had to investigate things. You know, and so my first formal exposures were to it were probably the employee orientation that we have every year for new professors and people on campus. And it was quite interesting to, you know, get the statistics because it was so heavily, the demographic is so heavily female here. Mm-hmm. It's a great thing. It's just that that's not necessarily what's in our communities. So, you know, me being the pragmatist that I am and trying to bring that realism into the classroom, it was a constant message that I had to put out there. As far as difficulty me navigating the whole thing, I don't see it that it was a gender issue for me necessarily. Dave was very open. Larry was very open. Ron, Steve, Don, they were all supportive. And Jim Vance, too, in Multicultural Affairs. I think, though, that when it came down to it, the socioeconomics were the bigger factor. I quit teaching on campus in 2005. So 3, 4, and 5. The tough part of that was, you know, the system cuts, you know, and it ended up affecting this campus the first year 23%. And 23% meant that a lot of stuff went out the window. Mm-hmm. That's close to a quarter of everything. And I was one of those things. Do I think that the campus is better off? No. Did it hurt? Absolutely. Is it still trying to recover? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it became a socioeconomic issue. And how easily people were just dismissed. And when you think about the traditional, I don't even know what the statistics are for this campus in terms of professors and administrators and the gender breakdown. But when you think about at that time, you know, it was Dave and Larry and everybody, you know, those are all male. Mm-hmm. There was not a female to turn to. Well, then Dave retired and Karen Kramer came in. And that was solid. That was cool. Mm-hmm. She was good. It was different, very different, and she was...
As far as within the department, right?
Yeah, department management, but she took it on temporarily.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, she wasn't in it for the long haul.
Yeah.
And then she retired. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's been this successive turnover. The destabilization of the structure has made it so that the people going into the positions are, you know, the strongest candidates possible. But your strongest candidates possible are not always your people of color, your women.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, where there has to be an active statement on diversity. You know, is it because this person thinks so radically different? Mm-hmm.